Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 27th, 2006. Today's session is entitled The Republican Right, Its Using of the Christian Right, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
Hello, welcome. Have you been to some of these talks? I'm John Marty, a member of the Minnesota Senate, and today's topic is sort of a follow-up to a talk I gave last week on moral values voters and how they influenced the 2004 election, or how we identified them and how they influenced the 2004 election and what might be happening in the 2006 election. And this is sort of a related topic. The name of it formally, the Republican Right and its using of the Christian Right. Look at how the Christian Right has been used by a political right to push its agenda. And I'm going to be reading extensively from Bill Moyers, who's a journalist and a Baptist Seminary graduate, and Bill McKibben, a faculty member at Middlebury College in Vermont and also a Methodist Sunday School teacher, mainly because they express things, they put things together in a very nice way that I thought was helpful. I'm going to argue in favor of the following premise and then open it up and hope we have a good discussion, whether you challenge that premise or add to it, modify it, whatever. But the premise that I was going to have, it's several premises, I guess, is that most Americans consider themselves Christian, though that means very different things to different people. And that right-wing political leaders and strategists realize a sizable chunk of this population could be appealed to under the terminology of Christianity, using motivation that I would argue is more self-centered than Christ-centered. And number three, that segment of the Christian population in their mind could be co-opted on behalf of their Christian agenda. I'd put Christian in quotes there because I would argue, again, as part of the premise, that it's often diametrically opposed to the teachings of Christ. But again, I'm going to put that out as a premise, make an argument for it, and then urge people to challenge or refine or whatever. And again, Bill McKibben, I mentioned, is a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. And on the first part of this, about how we are we a nation made up of Christians, the way he defined it, he says ours is the most spiritually homogenous, among the most spiritually homogenous rich nations on earth. And we think of ourselves as very diverse because of all the different Christian, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Islamic, Hindu. We're a melting pot. But he points out, depending on which poll you look at and how the question is asked, somewhere around 85% of us call ourselves Christian. Israel, by way of comparison, is 77% Jewish. So he's making the case we're very heavily Christian. And while we identify ourselves as Christian, we have very interesting perspectives. He would argue, perhaps, and I would agree, that there are different levels of biblical literacy, perhaps. And he says only 40% of Americans can name more than four of the Ten Commandments. A scant half can recite any of the four authors of the Gospels. 12% believe Joan of Arc was Noah's wife. That's always interesting to me. I saw a poem that had that. And he talks about how that may not matter much to our Christian heritage and so on, but he said, here's a statistic that does matter. 3/4 of Americans believe the Bible teaches that God helps those who help themselves. That is, 3 out of 4 Americans believe this uber-American idea, a notion at the core of our current individualist policies and culture, which was in fact uttered by Ben Franklin, actually appears in Holy Scripture. The thing is, not only is Franklin's wisdom not biblical, it's counter-biblical. Few ideas could be further from the gospel message with its radical summons to love of neighbor. On this essential matter, most American Christians, are simply wrong, as if 75% of American scientists believe Newton proved gravity causes apples to fly up. Anyway, as I said, he's a colorful writer and an interesting way of putting things. But I see it as, I've seen it in a way that I think that conservative political and corporate leaders have recognized this and have, in many times, taken advantage of it. And I would argue they sell a Christian agenda that's not not what we'd find from Christ's words, and certainly one that they use as a political trump card. Best example I have of using God as a trump card in politics was when Pat Robertson ran for president, I think it was 1988, he made a big point of the fact that, I don't know if you use the word endorsement, but his campaign was backed and supported by Jesus Christ, which is kind of, Doonesbury had a great cartoon where one reporter's asking, covering the news conference, and one said to the other, Robertson says, "My campaign's been endorsed by Jesus Christ." And the reporter says to the other one, "Sure beats the endorsement from the Teamsters." Endorsements, Robertson had a way of putting it. Anyway, the values that they promote as under the guise of Christianity are evident in the media. They're evident in what people who would call themselves moral values voters would identify with. And I think many Christians have never heard any interpretation of Scripture other than what is given to them by religious and political leaders. They talk about government being the enemy. That's not necessarily anti-biblical, but it's also not something that's a biblical theme. It's a very much an anti-tax agenda. I would argue an anti-human services agenda as well. But Bill Moyers talks about how the political right is turned and worked closely with the Christian right leaders to promote the agenda. And I wanted, as I said, to quote from, this is all from a speech he made in March of this year at Wake Forest Divinity School. And I'll comment on it as I go, but I wanted to read a number of paragraphs. This is Moyers. "The corporate, so political, and religious right converged in a movement that for a long time only they understood because they're its advocates, its architects, and its beneficiaries. Their religious strategy was to fuse ideology and theology into a worldview freed of the impurities of compromise, claim for America the status of God's favored among nations, and therefore beyond political critique or challenge, and demonize their opponents as ungodly and immoral." And I'll interrupt here to give one example of this. And this is, he gave several speeches on this, General William Boykin, who was, the administration distanced themselves from his comments, but he did get promoted to a new position in the Iraq conflict. Anyway, General Boykin, in a number of speeches, several of them wearing uniform, maybe all of them, but I know in some of them he was, declared that the United States is hated by other nations because we are, quote, a Christian nation. He said, quote, "Our spiritual enemy can only be conquered when we confront them in the name of God." He goes on to make it clear they're on the side of Satan and identifies their enemy as Muslims. Quote, "They worship a false God. We are an army of God raised up for such a time as this." And I think that very much makes the point that Moyers is saying, that we are God's chosen people. Our efforts are God's efforts, and the other side is demons, ungodly, immoral. And I think some of that's come out in the criticism of people who dare to challenge American policy. Almost, you're a traitor if you challenge administration policy, which is in our political system dangerous, because we have to have the debate where you don't question the other side's patriotism over and over, but we're getting to times where the names of legislation, Patriot Act, how dare you vote against a Patriot Act bill unless you're unpatriotic? Anyway, back to Moyers. You've heard about Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff, I'm sure. Let me tell you a little more than what you might have heard. Tom DeLay was a small businessman from Sugarland, Texas, who ran a pest extermination business before he entered politics. He hated the government regulators who dared tell him some of the pesticides he used were dangerous, as unfortunately they were. DeLay got himself elected to the Texas legislature at a time when Republicans were becoming the majority in the once solid Democratic South. His reputation for joining the wild parties at the state capitol earned him the nickname Hot Tub Tom. But early in his career, he did change on this. Early in his career, with exquisite timing and the help of some videos from the right-wing political evangelist James Dobson, Tom DeLay found Jesus and became a full-fledged born-again Christian. He would, in time, humbly acknowledge that God had chosen him to restore America to its biblical worldview. "God," said Tom DeLay, has been walking me through an incredible journey. God is using me all the time, everywhere. God is training me. God is working with me. To which Moyers adds, yes, indeed, God does work in mysterious ways. But, and I would interrupt here again to say that I think there are many times that conservative political leaders have found religion, and the religion they find very much is one that justifies their politics. I would guess that that happens on other sides as well, but it seems I've heard many times when people are coming to religion and politics, they seem to find out something that justifies what they have. And because they're using blatant appeals to their religious faith in the electoral process and so on, I think that's worth mentioning. But Moyers continues, just last month, Jack Abramoff, this is again March, Jack Abramoff pleaded guilty to fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials. And here Moyers articulates connections between Abramoff, Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, who's the head of that anti-tax Americans for Tax Reform Committee, and Ralph Reed, who headed Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition. And the connections of these folks, I think it happens at all, but Ralph Reed were heads of college Republicans at one point. He's talking about how many of the leaders of the conservative movement came out of the college Republicans. Ralph Reed, who was, again, as I said, the head of the Christian Coalition a number of years ago, made the cover of Time magazine as, quote, the right hand of God. They were using the play of words on the political right, the Christian right. Ralph Reed is currently running for lieutenant governor. I think it's of Alabama. It's either Alabama or Georgia. He's running as lieutenant governor on that. The primary may have happened since we got here, but I don't know whether he won or not. Anyway, it's... Moyers continues, Abramoff made his name, so to speak, representing Indian tribes with gambling interests. Before it was over, the Indian tribes had paid him $82 million, much of it going directly into Abramoff and his colleague Scanlon's pockets. But some of the money found its way to the righteous. Ralph Reed, for one, had his hand out. Reed was the religious rights poster boy against gambling. Quote, we believe gambling is a cancer on the American body politic, Reed had said. Quote, it is stealing food from the mouths of children and turning wives into widows, close quote. Moyers continues, Reed was right about that, of course, but his distaste for gambling was no match for his desire to make himself some moolah by helping protect Abramoff's gambling interests. When Reed resigned from the Christian Coalition just as it was coming under federal investigation, he sent Abramoff an email, quote, now that I'm leaving electoral politics, I need to start humping in corporate accounts. I'm counting on you to help me with some contacts. Moyers continues, Abramoff came through. According to published reports, he and his partner, Michael Scanlon, paid Reed some $4 million to whip up Christian opposition to gambling initiatives that could cut into the profits of Abramoff's clients. Reed called in some of the brightest stars of the Christian firmament, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, James Dobson, Phyllis Schlafly, to participate in what became a ruse on Abramoff's behalf. They would oppose gambling on religious and moral grounds in strategic places, Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, at decisive moments when competitive challenges threatened Abramoff's clients. Bogus Christian fronts were part of the strategy. Preachers in Texas rallied to Reed's appeals. Unsuspecting folks in Louisiana turned on their radios one day to hear the voice of God, with Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson doing the honors, thundering against a riverboat gambling scheme which Abramoff wanted defeated because it threatened one of his own gambling clients. Reed even got James Dobson, whose nationwide radio ministry reaches millions of people, to deluge the phone lines at the Interior Department in the White House with calls from indignant Christians. In 1999, Abramoff arranged from the Mississippi Choctaws, who were trying to stave off competition from other tribes, to contribute over $1 million to Northwest Americans for Tax Reform, which then passed the money on to the Alabama Christian Coalition and another anti-gambling group Reed had duped into aiding the cause. It's unclear how much these Christian soldiers marching as to war knew about the true purpose of their crusade, but Ralph Reed knew all along that his money was coming from Abramoff when he fiddled his brethren on the Christian right dance. And that's the end of Moyers talking specifically about how the Christian right ties into it, though Ralph Reed continues on, and Moyers continues in a few more paragraphs. It gets worse, and here we get to the heart of darkness. Here's where it talks about how it affects real people's lives. One of Abramoff's first big clients was the Northern Marianas Islands in the Pacific. After World War II, the Marianas became trusteeship of the UN, administered by the U.S. government under the stewardship of the Interior Department. The islands were exempted from U.S. labor and immigration laws, and over the years, tens of thousands of people, primarily Chinese, mostly women, were brought there as garment workers to live in crowded barracks in miserable conditions. The main island, Saipan, became known as America's biggest sweatshop. In 1998, a government report found workers there suffered severe malnutrition and health problems and subjected to unprovoked acts of violence. Many had signed shadow contracts which required them to pay up to $7,000 just to get the job. They had to renounce their claim to basic human rights, forbidden to engage in political and religious activities, to socialize, or to marry. Some of the biggest names in retail clothing industry were enabled to slap "Made in the USA" labels on their clothes and import them to America while paying the workers practically nothing. When these scandalous conditions began to attract attention, the sweatshop moguls fought all efforts at reform. Knowing that Jack Abramoff was close to Tom DeLay, they hired him to lobby for the islands. And then he talks about how they had members of Congress visit the islands on carefully guided junkets, conservative intellectuals and journalists for rates higher, considerably above what the women on the islands were making, also signed up for expense-free trips to Marianas. They flew first class, dined in posh restaurants, slept in comfort at the beachfront hotel, returned to write and speak of the islands as, quote, a true free market success story, and, quote, a laboratory of liberty. Abramoff took Tom DeLay and his wife there, too. DeLay practically swooned. He said the Marianas represented what's best about America. He called them my Galapagos, a perfect petri dish of capitalism. Then it says these fellow travelers became a solid phalanx aimed at any and all attempts to provide workers with a living wage and decent living conditions. When a liberal California Democrat, George Miller, and a conservative Alaska Senator, Frank Murkowski, both indignant at the appalling conditions, tried to raise minimum wages and at least prevent arbitrary deportation of the workers, they were stopped cold. After 2000 election, the spoils of victory divided up. Abramoff got himself named to the Bush transition team for the Interior Department. He wanted to make sure the right people wound up overseeing his clients in the Marianas. He enlisted Ralph Reed, who said he'd raised the matter with Rove to at least stop one appointment to Interior that might prove troublesome. So this time, Reed wrote an email to Enron's top lobbyist, touting his pal Abramoff as arguably the most influential and effective GOP lobbyist in Congress. I share several clients with him. Have yet to see him lose a battle. He's also very close to DeLay and could help enormously on that front. And Moyers wraps it up on this. For his services to the Marianas, Jack Abramoff was paid nearly $10 million. To this day, workers in the Marianas are still denied the federal minimum wage while working long hours for subsistence income in their, quote, little petri dish of capitalism, America at its best. And Moyers says, there are no victimless crimes in politics. The cost of corruption is passed on to the people. When government of the United States falls under the thumb of powerful and privileged, regular folks get squashed. And so again, the first part of that, where he's talking about how he was using the Christian right there, the same figures, the Ralph Reeds of the world, who, again, he's no longer affiliated with the Christian Coalition. He's now a candidate on his own, and between that time, he was a fellow lobbyist with Abramoff. But they turned to their friends, and their friends have been including people who, I would argue, sincere Christians who are upset about gambling. They're preached to, this is it, you got to contact Congress now. And Minnesota has some of these same kind of gambling disputes going on. And some of us who don't like gambling at all kind of wonder how sometimes people, they're really against gambling, except when it's their client who they're talking about, in which case they seem to be very interested. But to wrap this up, I wanted to go back to Bill McKibben again for a couple minutes. And McKibben says, McKibben's quoting Jesus on when I was talking about the poverty issues and how he talks earlier about how the Ben Franklin quote about God helps those who help themselves, and how that's not necessarily, that's directly contradictory to God's message to others. He quotes, when one of the Pharisees asked Jesus what the core of the law was, Jesus replied, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." And McKibben writes, "Love your neighbor as yourself. although its rhetorical power has been dimmed by its repetition, that is a radical notion, perhaps the most radical notion possible, especially since Jesus in all his teachings made it very clear who the neighbor you're supposed to love was, the poor person, the sick person, the naked person, the hungry person. The last shall be made first, turn to the other cheek, on and on and on, a call for nothing less than radical, voluntary, and effective reordering of power relationships based on the principle of love. And he continues, a rich man came to Jesus one day and asked what he should do to get into heaven. Jesus did not say he should invest, spend, and let the benefits trickle down. He said, sell what you have, give your money to the poor, and follow me. Few plainer words have been spoken, yet for some reason, the Christian Coalition of America, founded in 1989, in order to, quote, preserve, protect, and defend the Judeo-Christian values that made this the greatest country on earth, proclaimed last year that its top legislative priority would be making permanent President Bush's 2001 federal tax cuts. And I would argue that it's not just on the economic issues where Christ's teachings have been twisted, I would argue, for political purposes. Here's one example McKibben uses where, and he's not, he's using it to talk about the death penalty here. He talks about how a furor erupted last spring when it emerged that a Colorado jury had consulted the Bible before sentencing a killer to death. Experts debated whether the jurors should have used an outside authority in their deliberations. And of course, the Christian rights are just one more sign of a secular society devaluing religion. But McKibben says, but a more interesting question would have been why the jurors fixated on Leviticus 24 with its call for an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. They had somehow missed Jesus' explicit refutation in the New Testament. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to the other also. And McKibben, again, I'm in the last couple paragraphs, sorry about this in length. McKibben goes on to explain why he sees the political Christian right having so much success in its message. He says the power of the Christian right rests largely on the fact that they boldly proclaim religious authority, and their very boldness convinced the rest of us that they must know what they're talking about. They're like the guy who gives you directions with such loud confidence that you drive on, even though the road appears to be turning into a faint, rutted track. And again, here we go to the bold confidence of Tom DeLay saying God put him here to push God's agenda, or General Boykin saying, we are fighting God's war, or Pat Robertson's, I've been endorsed by Jesus Christ. But McKibben says, but their theology is appealing for another reason too. And this is a fact of reality for the Christian church. The theology is appealing for another reason too. It coincides with what we want to believe. How nice it would be if Jesus declared the income was ours to keep instead of insisting we had to share. How satisfying it would be if we were supposed to hate our enemies. Religious conservatives will always have a comparatively easy sell. But straight is the path and narrow the way. The gospel is too radical for any culture larger than the Amish to ever come close to realizing. In demanding a departure from selfishness, it conflicts with all our current desires. And he says, even the first time around, judging by the reaction, the gospels were pretty unwelcome news to an awful lot of people. He says, there's not going to be a modern-day return to the church of the early believers holding all things in common. That's not what I'm talking about. Taking seriously the actual message of Jesus, though, should at least moderate the greed and violence that marked this culture. It's hard to imagine a con more audacious than making Christ the front man for a program of tax cuts for the rich or for war in Iraq. And that's where, I mean, I would argue that that's the way the religious world is seen by the media and by large portions of the public. Go back 70 years, there were different times in American life. Franklin Roosevelt expressed moral principle that he argued should govern our nation. He said, the test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, it's whether we provide enough to those who have too little. And this is, I would argue, the opposite of what we're hearing in recent years in Washington and in many states. McKibben talks in his thing about how we compare to the rest of the world in terms of economic giving, how we're second to last among developed nations in economic aid to poorer countries. And he says, well, some could argue, well, that's government giving. But he says it's 15 cents a person per day is what they calculate our entire economic development aid overseas is. He says you throw in charitable giving, private giving, it adds another 6 cents a day, so 21 cents a day. We're still one of the lowest countries among all the developed countries in it. And he questions whether Christian nation should be this way. But I was also going to argue in terms of the trends now, we do have well over 30 million people in poverty. We have more than 10% of our population without any health care insurance at any time. There's a growing number of people who are on and off depending on employment and so on. But 2 years ago, the Christian right was speaking in the 2004 election, was speaking openly about how Christians would be voting for George Bush. And leaders like Jerry Falwell suggested you couldn't be Christian unless you were voting for Bush. The moral values we talked about in that year were nothing about poverty, nothing about things like that. They were support for display of the Ten Commandments on courthouse lawns, or support for schools teaching creation science as creationism is science. It was opposition to same-sex marriages. Perhaps the only speech that tapped into Christ, the only major speech in the 2004 election that tapped into Christ's plea to love your neighbor as yourself was one that Barack Obama gave at the Democratic Convention, where he said, and this was a nice way of putting it, he's an articulate guy, along with our famous individualism, which I think we all recognize our country, unlike most others, has a very strong thread of individualism in it. So along with our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga, a belief that we are connected as one people. If there's a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me, even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for her prescription and has to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poor, even if it's not my grandmother. It's that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. So it allows us to pursue our individual dreams, yet still come together as an American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. That was the only speech of any candidate, the presidential candidates, or anyone that I heard that talked about concern for those without. 40 years ago, Christian values were used to push for issues like medical care for the poor, for seniors. We've talked about civil rights, and like prior movements for abolition of slavery and for New Deal, for economic fairness, there was a strong Christian mention in that, and I would suggest that part of the change now is that many people who favor these things don't talk openly, they don't address it. The church in recent years has been changing this some, but don't talk openly about any biblical connection, any moral imperative for doing these things. It's just, we ought to do it because it's good policy. But at the same time, we're seeing by the Christian right, which I would argue is being heavily directed by the political right, is using Christ's name to invoke in ways that are used to urge people to put themselves first, and the Lord helps those who help themselves is being used as a sort of a gospel of greed and selfishness that's being used to tap into other agendas that may not be shared by many of the people who are reciting that and believing that. I've talked for about half an hour, and I hope that this stimulates, I assume, some controversy and some discussion about those points. And with that, I'll open it up and see which way it goes.
And just bring one thing to mind, why is that? What is our failure with that? Why is it so easy for people to be swayed that way? And I see it as a failure with our own church, that we're not speaking enough to each other and bringing more people in and educating our own people. We're just sort of drifting along and doing sort of what we do, but we're pretty much at fault for not taking the lead on that.
I welcome comments, but I'll make one, and that is, I think, church, when you talk about sharing with those who have less, that the way to be a success is to give people what they want. And the gospel message isn't always that way. I guess I think the church is you talk about which churches are growing. They're the ones that tell people what they want. McKibben's article, which was actually in Harper's Magazine Harper's Magazine in August 2005, talks a lot about how the church is now, he says, this is fine stuff that they're teaching. He talks about firm believers, aerobics course at a church he's talking about. He talks about all the programs on better parenting and self-fulfillment things, and he talks about they're good things. People need better parenting help and so on. It's not explicitly a Christian message. It's not anti-Christian. He just says that churches tend to focus on their own and what people want, and it's a very tough message to sell, helping others. And one comment on that is that the only message that does work, well, I would argue for the churches, it better not be. But in the political world, I noticed in Minnesota, I'll take Hubert Humphrey, who was a Minnesotan and an aw shucks kind of corny at times, perhaps, politician, but I read plenty of things from him in the 60s and 70s talking about, in his corny way, by golly, we Minnesotans are good people, and we care about our seniors in the nursing homes. We care about the poor. We care about others. And people respond to that. Yeah, we are good people. We do care about them. People respond to what you appeal to. In more recent years, who can better spend your money, you or that evil government? And I think there's a whole lot of, if you appeal to the generosity in people, people respond. If you appeal to their greed, they respond, because we all have both of those in us. And again, last night when we were talking about the war, for those of you who are here, I keep thinking in the Depression, right after the Depression, World War II, how people had to sacrifice and do it for the troops. Gas rationing, so we didn't use up too much rubber of tires, because we had a shortage of it. Now we're told, what do you do to support the war effort, support the troops, support our country after 9/11? Go shop. People respond to that. You tell them, look out for yourself, and they do it.
But what can we do to help people to elicit that response from people? Should we co-opt some of their tactics? But use them in our own best interest, in our own
I life? Welcome comments on that. Yes.
Well, I think one of the things that happened in American churches is that there was, say, for example, in the 60s, in the War on Poverty and the anti-war movement, powerful coalitions of people who acted out of religious conviction and people who acted out of more generalized convictions. And the rules of political etiquette at that time said you don't talk about these conflicting basis of action. And this would be an interesting thing to talk to Nellie about, in the way that she's been talking about the importance of acting together without having the discussion, the argument about different motives. But unfortunately, I think one of the things that happened in the more mainstream and liberal churches is then we depended too much on the assumption that we all knew that we had those religious convictions, and so we didn't generate that enough conversation in our congregations about that, and then don't speak it in public. So all of that is then to come up to the danger that the religious right claims that they have the authority to say what the scripture says, that they can speak on behalf of God. Those of us who have a different understanding have almost forgotten how to speak in public about our religious convictions. And it impoverishes the public debate, and it also impoverishes our churches that we're not making those connections among people of faith. And one sort of small example of that I found quite interesting after the last presidential election was, and I'm blanking on her name, the woman who writes in the back of Newsweek,
Anna Quinlan,
wrote one day, people are accusing me of being this secularized, anti-religious person. They don't know that I go to Mass every week. They don't know that my three boys all have been altar boys and gone to confirmation and blah, blah, blah. Why don't they know it? Well, they don't know it because she never said it before. And something about the way in which the religious right claims to own all of this. So what can we do? We need to just say something, to just say in public, the reason I'm then I discovered that that wasn't the way everybody thought. So why do I'm feminist? Because I went to confirmation class. And that's sort of stunning to people. But I should say
it,
that.
It is, I mean, well, I mean, the. I know a lot of my colleagues, I mean, after last year, now Democrats are talking, oh, we've got to expand the definition of what moral values are and change the terminology and so on. And one politician I know said, Democrats ought to start going to church and being obvious about it. And I thought, that's offensive to me. It's really offensive to me, first of all, because a lot of Democrats do go to church. And second of all, just because you do, doesn't mean you should be using it politically. And again, it's a difficult thing. I mean, I've gotten more outspoken. We've had a big debate in Minnesota, as many states, about the gay marriage issue this year. And as one who, I mean, in many ways is the, I mean, 25-year marriage and everything else, and happens to believe we should legalize gay marriage, not just keep it out of the Constitution. I had all kinds of very worse 2 years ago than this year, but very angry, challenging everything about who I am and my faith and everything else. I respond to them when attacked, I respond on it. But it's a shame that we get to this point where we have to feel, it's the same thing, your patriotism is questioned if you challenge federal government policy, your religious beliefs are challenged if you challenge somebody else's economic policy.
In the state of Washington, just recently, we've seen something of a resurgence on the Christian left, if you will. The legislature, after 30 years of trying, finally passed by one vote in the state Senate a gay civil rights bill. Not gay marriage, just basically assuring them of basic civil rights. And there was a referendum campaign launched to try to get enough signatures to overturn that. And a number of mainstream Christian leaders, including the Episcopal bishop for Western Washington, spoke out against it and said, this is, you know, our religious convictions tell us this is where we should be on this. And ultimately, the referendum did not get enough signatures to qualify for the ballot. I wish I could say it was because of the mainstream religious leaders' influence. I think it was more the result of logistical problems on the part of the conservatives. But I'm wondering if you see any kind of a resurgence in Minnesota or nationally on the part of Christian leaders who disagree with the religious right and are speaking out more.
Yeah, I think they very definitely are. I mean, Jim Wallace, who's not a liberal, he describes himself as an evangelical Christian, he's editor of Sojourners and so on. He talks about one of the issues we ought to, Democrats, he said, they're terrible about talking about their religion. Maybe because they want to be tolerant and everything else, but he talks about George Bush describes his favorite philosopher as Jesus Christ and very open about his faith. The last Democratic president who was that way was Jimmy Carter. I mean, Bill Clinton wasn't hiding it or anything, but clearly Jimmy Carter felt so comfortable about it, he freaked out the American people. He took his faith very seriously. And people don't like it too seriously. We got to pay lip service, but not much more than that. But I think the mainline churches and so on tend to be getting more vocal in Minnesota and a lot of communities on issues like, again, the gay marriage issue. In Minnesota, the Catholic Archdiocese, which had been very vocal on anti-poverty things in recent years, came out, surprising to me, very strongly anti-gay marriage. I'm not surprised they were opposed, but that they made it a high priority issue. There was one woman who worked in their family life division who pressed it very hard, and a couple of the bishops were near retirement and didn't want to get in a fight, and a couple others were supportive, and one way or another they became very vocally there. But there was I think 2 years ago when the debate came up, people heard one voice from the Christian community was anti-gay marriage, whereas this past time I think for church leaders on both sides of it, and very vocal, which points out to what it is. In my mind, it's a religious debate. I don't think anybody should tell a church whether they should who they can marry and who they can't. I don't think it belongs in government to be telling people who they can marry and which churches, which marriages they can consecrate. But
civil unions for everyone.
Yeah, but again, the church voice, we kept being told, it's not a religious issue, though they're using the churches to do it. In my mind, it is very definitely a religious issue, and I don't think anybody should tell any church who they can marry and who they can't. That should be up to the church. But again, the religious mainstream denominations started getting more vocal this past year. They've been, in the last few years, Lutherans and Catholics, particularly about anti-poverty issues, because poverty in Minnesota and health insurance for poor and so on has been being cut year after year after year. And I think they've been getting more vocal on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I work in a school that's 98% poverty. And I mean, I hear so much about gay marriage and abortion. And I'm like, what about the kids that are already here and born? I got kids this summer that won't get meals, that will be hungry because they don't get fed at school. I got kids who have untreated asthma. I've got kids, I mean, every day I work with these kids and I never hear about them in the news. That I've got kids who never get their clothes washed because their mom's social services got cut and now she can't do clothes. I had a kid throw up on his clothes. He came back 3 days later with the same shirt on. His mom can't wash his clothes because they cut her money. And to me, those issues are, those living children are more important than gay marriage or abortion, because they're alive, they need help now. And I mean, most people don't work with them like I don't see that. But I know a lot of churches do volunteer work in those areas and stuff, but I just would like to hear more about that in politics, because these kids need help now, they're not getting it.
But lots of people have described the gay marriage issue as a wedge issue, one to stimulate debate, and when things go, I mean, some have argued that things go poorly on economic issues or military issues or something else, then you raise the...
So you don't talk about the other stuff.
Yeah, you channel the debate. Yeah. Karl Rove is apparently very good at changing debate on things like that. I do think that some of that balance is out in the public. The woman who in Minnesota is the author of the anti-gay marriage constitutional amendment, she's been pushing it for years. We voted it down. I'm on the committee, that Judiciary Committee, that dealt with it 2 years ago. Immediately after that, she kept, every day she'd be bringing up on the floor, it seemed, constantly on any bill and everything else. This past year, it got voted down again, and we were all waiting for the end of the year for it to happen. And it didn't happen, it never came up again. And I think it's partly because she's running for Congress. And while it was a great issue for her fundraising and got her the position where she would run for Congress, it also, I think, it became something that the public was thinking, doesn't she have anything else she cares about? Because she just kept drumming on and on and on. And I think people, not just concerned for the poor, but for schools in general, for everything, I think people were saying, isn't there more to one's agenda than that? So I think that there is a balancing, and the public gets too much of it if you go too far.
I have no personal love for Karl Rove, but I think he's the most brilliant political strategist that we've ever seen in years. And he certainly courting the Christian right, no questions about that. But I think what he's really sensed is a large portion of America is really hungry for simple stability, simple conservative values, no change, and I think that that's partly because of the issues of the times, the disappearance of manufacturing jobs and a whole raft of issues, and he finds the Christian right particularly immersed in that status quo type of behavior. And so he's gone after, you know, I think it's coincidence that there's other people other than Christian right who feel that way, but almost all the Christian right is having trouble with the changes in our society.
That may be, I don't disagree with you, that may be the nature of a what we've called fundamentalist religion. People who are scared of change because change is happening all around us whether we like it or not. And some people, I mean, I think until the moral majority in the late 70s, early 80s came around, many of the fundamentalist Christians didn't want anything to do with politics. That was bad stuff. It's we don't like it. And they pretty much, I mean, some very conservative religious denominations don't let people vote. You're not supposed to have anything to do with government. But they changed that and got very heavily involved. But I think it is very much, when times go bad, well, it's because of gay marriage. It's because all of a sudden, I mean, there have been gay partnerships for hundreds of years. And but now it's, you know, things are going bad, you blame it on that. Oh, all our marriages are breaking up. I mean, if you think about the argument, I don't care whether somebody favors or opposes gay marriage, the argument that it's going to have an impact on my marriage somehow, that another man marries another man or a woman marries another woman, that it's going to have any impact on mine, I've yet to hear anybody make a cogent argument. I've debated colleagues. They don't ever, they just say it's a harmful thing to other marriages. And yeah, we do have very big problems with divorce in this country and all, a whole lot of other things. But it's, again, you want something to blame. And I think the same thing, the fundamentalist Islamic movement relies on that too. The extreme poverty, who do you blame? It's those infidels in the West. I think that's sort of the nature of fundamentalist religions. You're uncomfortable with what's happening, and you cling to some fundamentals of your religion.
Well, just to expand on that a little bit, you mentioned the Amish earlier, and I don't want to pick on the Amish, but just use them as a case in point of that kind of us and them mentality. The idea being that we establish what is our community based on our core values, and we live those out as fully as we can. And Dem English, that's what they refer to, the folks who are not part of the sect or the community, are all the rest who are outside of that. Well, I think in our religious right, we have an awful strong preponderance for people who are used to thinking and find it attractive in their understanding to think of that us-them kind of sense. And you can think of the whole business about the rapture and all of that kind of popular jargon, and we've had our own Barbara Rossing, obviously one of the teaching staff here often, who's put that to rest with her book. But, you know, it still hasn't, that whole counterpoint hasn't yet taken a full enough root for people to realize that really we have to be talking about all of us and not just the us versus them. And that my welfare and my community prospers when the rest are left behind or left aside. And I think part of the liberal agenda, if there is such a thing, clear cut, is a more inclusive, redrawing the circle to be more inclusive of more diversity and more folks who have historically been oppressed or marginalized. And so therein lies this, that's a much more difficult task of how do you draw that circle, whereas when it's an us and them, you can have convenient alliances with that same kind of paradigm of the us and them, that they can be allied for convenience sake. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with this political right and the so-called Christian right. It's really, I think, a matter of convenience about the us and them mentality, and we have yet to see where this is going to play out, but I think eventually it will play out.
Well, one thing I want to, I'm not sure, I don't think it's disagreeing with what you're saying, but I wanted to say there is a distinction in my mind between the Amish and the Christian right in the sense, because much of what we now call the Christian right, we're like the Amish. I mean, we want to, it's a very fundamentalist religion. We want to have, and probably the early church was that way too. The rest of the world, they can do what they want, but we're going to do this. And the Amish, very much they're to themselves, which doesn't cause a lot of problems for society at large. I mean, there's some bending you have to do with the lights on buggies going along the roads, but they comply with our laws with asking for little bits of modification. But they live their own life, and they may not like what we do, but they don't care. It's your life, leave us alone and do it. And that's kind of where it's changed here now, where you have people saying, we want you to live by, we want the Ten Commandments on the courthouse lawn, because it's our scripture, and our choice of scripture anyway. We don't want the Beatitudes on public property. Those are Christ's words, and I think that a lot of people think it would be a big controversy. Blessed are the peacemakers at the Pentagon, and so on. But that was E.J. DeYoung pointed that out. Yes?
I don't have this thought fully articulated, but it's related to the us and them.
and to the fact that the Christian, so-called Christian right has robbed Christians in general of things like the meaning of being evangelical, of living out your faith, them kind of got very organized. What's the call to us to get organized, you know? Like, where's the response to the Ten Commandments with the Beatitudes? I think somehow in this movement, left behind are those of us who are Christians that can't stay in particular churches because of particular organizational stances about what's Christian and what's not. Somehow there hasn't been quite the movement up front of Christians standing up enough for beliefs that don't fit into this paradigm of the Christian right.
It may be partly that, I mean, it looks from an outsider that the Christian right is very unified. We all agree on a whole lot of things, and maybe that's just glossing over things, but there are plenty of disagreements with people in mainline churches who can't agree on much of anything, it seems. They agree on a whole lot of points, but they have little differences here and there that cause disagreement. But Jim Wallace, again, from Sojourners, he and Tony Campolo and some other evangelical Christians, they cause great headaches, except they never get the voice that Christian right gets. They cause great headaches for them. And Jim Wallace says, yeah, he had a friend who cut out all the verses in the Bible that talked about the poor, concern for the poor. He said there was nothing left. It was just the Bible was gutted. There was nothing but a few torn pages here and there. But Tony Campolo, they're very vocal about it. Tony Campolo said he was invited once, I think, to this, I don't know if it was Southern Baptist Convention or where, but he was invited once and never again. Why? They complained he took the Bible too literally. or they believe they take the Bible literally, but he believed it, and he tried to live it out. And there's a line, I'll use it here because I don't know if I'm going to use it. I have Vespers in a couple nights, and it's a line I wanted to use, but I don't know if I should or not. But Tony Campolo often addressed evangelical audiences with the line, he said, it bugs the shit out of me that there are 30,000 kids who died yesterday because of hunger and poverty. He says, it bugs me even more that you're probably more bothered by the fact they use the word shit than the 30,000 kids died yesterday. He's a very creative speaker. But I think that there aren't a lot of people like that. They're both evangelicals who are very outspoken about their thing, and they're in the evangelical movement and very offended by how the evangelical movement is being pushed into this very conservative right wing. Yes?
I guess my question is, how do we, I think that Jim Wallace, it refers to the fact that our language has been hijacked.
Yeah.
It's been taken away from us. And how do we get that language back? I mean, I think the title of Jim Wallace's book, you know, that the why the right is wrong and the left don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, how do we get that language back so that it isn't identified with Christians kind of maybe incorrectly or improperly?
It would help if the media was a little more open to things like this. Bill Moyers wrote he said on his Now show a few years ago before he left it, he intentionally pinned on a little lapel pin flag. And he talked about how he was doing it. He said he found it somewhat offensive in the past that people would pin a little lapel flag on them. He pointed how the president and vice president wore one at the State of the Union address and so on. And that people they were kind of challenging the patriotism of anybody that way. And I've seen a lot of my colleagues do it. We got to wear the flag and so on. Well, you know, I kind of think I shouldn't be questioned on my patriotism if I don't wear a flag. But I've learned you better talk about things that you do. We've flown a flag in front of our house for 25 years after 9/11. There were lots of flags down our street. Most of them, there are one or two left still. But I keep thinking, whose flag is it? It's not some right-wing agenda's flag, though I got to confess I suffered from this once. I had been given a state and Minnesota flag by local American Legion post when I was in First Selected. Connie complained that my office didn't look very senatorial, and former head of the Veterans Department in Minnesota, worked in the Senate those days, and so he called some of his friends at the VFW in my home community, and they donated me a flag, a set of flags, which are apparently very expensive, but they had charitable gambling, which is our fundraising. And they gave me a very nice set of flags, and I remember writing them a letter saying, you know, I was very honored to get this, and I didn't think they should be for me. I said I promised to give them to my successor when I left office, because I think every Senate office ought to have a set of flags in it. The state didn't provide them, and they did. And about 6-7 years later, we had a flag-burning resolution to Congress. Happened to be a bad year for me to vote the way I did on. I was running for governor. But I voted against it. There were 6 no votes. All the people who would most likely say, hey, flag burning, we shouldn't amend the Constitution. First time we're ever going to amend the Bill of Rights, because somebody, 10 people every 20 years protest by burning a flag. And they probably like the attention if they get arrested for it too. But I just thought it was not what the flag stands for in my mind. So I did that, and I voted that way, and a couple weeks later, the VFW folks came, met me outside the chamber, and handed me, like, here, read this. And I'm like, yes, sir, I'll read it. And it demanded, because I didn't have any respect for the flag, that I return the flag that they had loaned me. It was not a loan, but I said, go ahead, take it. I'm offended that you think, if you don't agree with you on every issue, that the flag doesn't belong to you. And but they took it, and group called Veterans for Peace, read about an editorial that actually said nice things about my standing up to it, and they brought me a new flag, which I told them, this one I'm not going to pass on to my successor, because this one is special for me, because I lost the other one. But again, that's a symbol of the flag, the cross, the other things like that. We shouldn't have to wear little lapel pins in order to show that we're Christian, or we're patriots, or we're whatever, but maybe we have to.
I think a lot of the comments that have been coming up show that there's already an us versus them mentality just within the church, between the more liberal Christians and the more conservative Christians. And I think a lot of us have a knee-jerk mentality against the other side, whichever side we're on. And it seems like it would be really important to find some common ground. Because otherwise we're just lobbing, you know, we're
thinking, which is useless.
Oh, those conservatives, they're just absolutely nuts. You know, what do they think? They're not helping the poor or the least of these, like it says in the Bible. They lob back saying, you know, you're not doing what the Bible says, and it's just this.
And to that we've got to give, right,
that's going to change.
That's a very real, it's a reality in what's going on in the churches. And that's why I think we've got to give credit to people who don't win any points because they're trying to mediate differences.
Yeah.
Take the gay marriage issue, which denominations may be split over. Congregations may be split over. And very, rightly or wrongly, very hotly contested issue. And I think the people who, they don't please anybody, but they're trying to hold something together, rather than say both sides accuse them, well, the ELCA, both sides accuse them of selling out, and I don't agree with what happened, but I kind of think I'm not going to criticize that decision, because they're trying to hold something together, and as people of faith, we better try and find common ground and say, look, I mean, I grew up Missouri Synod Lutheran, and they, 1970, the Synod got a new president and others, and they charged the president of the seminary and 2 or 3 senior faculty members with heresy. I mean, heresy strikes me as something you had a few hundred years ago, but you charge them with heresy, and you don't agree with us on everything, and they kicked out the group. They became known as the moderates, because the conservatives called them the moderates, because their view was, we don't have to agree on every interpretation of Scripture. We can still get along, but that group said, nope, you're either with us or you're against us, and you can't have a different view. But I think we do need to try and pull together anytime we can.
Well, I'm grateful for the comment about the Amish, and also for your response, because a really important part of these discussions about religion and politics is to remember that over hundreds of years, Christians have had various views of how the church and the civic arena and the civic government should be in relationship to each other. And so the Amish saying, we don't want anything to do with it. We will have our own community is very different than the sort of legacy of the New England colonial, we are going to make a city on a hill, but expected everybody to be part of it. So the notion that Christianity will transform its whole culture, that the law should all, it's almost like Sharia, you know, that we should have Christian laws for our country. But there are other options. The one that Lutherans have taken of a more paradoxical interactive, where sometimes we are in favor of what the government does, and sometimes we're opposed to what the government does. And we disagree among ourselves. I've written on this a little bit, and one of the things that was so interesting to me about the last governor's election in Minnesota is we had three tickets, so six people running. Five of the six people were Lutherans. So that's why we don't talk about a Lutheran vote, even in states where 25% of the voters are Lutheran. You think that there would be a Lutheran vote, but guess what? My vote gets canceled out by my brother. I bet on every single issue. You know? And he's in church every Sunday too. I'm his kid's godmother. Well, let's see, you know, maybe I could get another vote for whatever. But it's complicated. And I think even without the substance of the issues of gay marriage, which are huge, it's such a fascinating issue because of the church-state business.
Right.
That when someone signs a marriage certificate, when a pastor signs a marriage certificate, they're doing that as a state official, right? They're doing a governmental act, not a religious act. It's a very strange point in our
Most of us would call our marriage what happens in the church, not the signing of the document, though.
But the document.
But the document is what gives you the legal rights.
Yep.
Yeah. Other things, and we've got just a minute or two more, but go ahead.
If you look at Protestantism, or even religion in America since the very early days, what you see is the organizations, religious organizations, as well as other organizations, who have a mechanism or a process for reconciliation of divergent positions have survived and expanded. And those who have taken monolithic positions do not survive. It's that simple. And the nation, which has done better than many nations in the world, with all our imperfections and all our shortcomings, we still comparatively have brought more, a lot of good things to a lot of people in terms of quality of life and everything. And you can find a whole list of things you don't like. But still, if you travel overseas, you see that it's still a pretty good place to live. We have a nation that has very rigid and very structured processes for reconciliation.
And that's one thing that worries me is that we're moving away from that, because we were the melting pot. We are the country that took people with religious freedom. You could disagree and still be part of society. You were not ostracized and kicked out. That's oversimplification. I mean, Dad will talk about when he was growing up, you couldn't talk to the Catholic kids in the town because they were set aside. You might be friends, but you couldn't be publicly friends. So it wasn't ever ideal, but there clearly is a diversity here, and one that we have to keep if we value it, and finding ways to get around this. I mean, I keep thinking times do change. 40 years ago, those activist courts intervened and overthrew 13, 14 states that had laws banning interracial marriage. The U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and said, you can't do that. And at that time, the church, Jerry Falwell and others, were very vocally opposed to it. You're stepping on our religious beliefs. And there are still some people who believe. There's one guy in Minnesota who wrote hate mail anytime. I got some of the letters, but most of the time they're aimed at interracial couples. He'd mail them and so on. He had given money to Augsburg College. They were going to name a building after him until it came out publicly who he was. But it's interesting. He's the only guy I know who's publicly going to say interracial marriages are wrong, whereas half the church, maybe not half, but a good number of people strongly oppose that. And I think issues like gay marriage is changing too. I mean, I noticed in Minnesota big changes on it. So we we have this bloody fight now about it, and who knows how it plays out 10 years from now, but I would guess that attitudes do change, and there's generally been a growing tolerance in our nation's history. It's a question, are we headed that way still or not? But